Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to the Ugly Pike podcast. I'm here in the studio with Frank.
Hello, hello.
Why not three hellos off the start there, Frank? So, welcome back, everyone. Today we have something really interesting. I think it's quite unique. Frank, do you want to introduce our guest today? I mean, I've been doing it a lot lately.
Yes, we have a specialist in aquatic ecology, Sarah Rabideau. She works particularly with esox, muskie, and pike, and is going to give us a very interesting view on her studies and her findings for the species.
The other thing, Sarah, she's been outdoors her whole life, and she has, I think, specific or a passion for water. All things water. So we're going to get more info on her bio. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Just so you know, Sarah, I was online doing some research on, you know, just kind of musky related stuff, and looking at some research papers regarding musky research, essentially, and I came across your name. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how we reached out to you, and that was like maybe 6 or 7 months ago, and then schedules being what they are, here we are today. Thanks for being patient with us, and we're really glad we can have you on and talk kind of technically and biologically about this species.
Yeah, I'm glad we were finally able to connect. I know it's been a lot of back and forth, but today's finally here.
The day is here, and it's interesting because we tend to focus a lot on experts and non-experts and approaches to catching muskie, but I think a big part of it, an important part of it, is understanding who and what these fish are and what they do. And so Sarah was really someone that jumped out at us, we've got some really good questions lined up, and I'm excited to hear about this.
So Sarah, you have a master's degree in fish biology, or what's your background? What's your educational kind of history that you focused on aquatic ecology? Can you give us a bit of, elaborate on that?
Yeah, for sure. So I am a recent grad from Dr. Stephen Cook's lab at Carleton University, and as you mentioned, I received my Master of Science. I'll be walking across the stage on November 10th to get that nice new piece of paper, which is great.
Congratulations.
I actually studied fish and wildlife at Fleming College. I did that for 3 years, and then I took a break, did a few contracts, and then I earned my Bachelor of Science degree at Trent University in Peterborough. So kind of throughout that whole journey, my career has really, I found it to concentrate on studying and monitoring often species at risk, particularly fish and turtles. I have an affinity for them. I love them. But as obviously me being on the show today, my master's thesis was focused on muskie. So I'm looking forward to chatting about that.
So I'll go, Frank, and then you can follow. Why exactly did you focus your thesis on muskie? I know from PhDs, they have to be very specialized, very kind of like a very specific thing you're studying. Why did you choose this muskie? And I'm sure it goes much more specific than that, but explain that for us.
Yes. Well, why muskie? Well, why not?
Well, we're happy about that.
They're elusive. They're difficult to find. Why not do a study on them, right?
Yeah.
But no, seriously. So my master's, it focused on better understanding how juvenile muskie and northern pike, so the two of them together, though the focus was on muskie, how they use their nursery bays in the fall and winter months. We've got a pretty good understanding of what the fingerlings do in the summertime, but we didn't really have much information on what happens in the fall and winter, which is obviously a pretty critical time for them. So what we did was we actually implanted each of the fish we captured with a small acoustic tag, and we tracked their movements in the bay. And this was to determine the how, the when, and the where they use their bays relative to timing, whether fish overlapped in the core areas they used, and how big these areas are. And importantly, we really wanted to know what habitat features they like to use most of the time to inform, future habitat restoration efforts. All of the work that my team and I had done, it was conducted in known spawning bays, where recruitment happens, in the Thousand Islands region of the Upper St. Lawrence River. Students and staff at the, it's called the Thousand Islands Biological Station. It's run out of SUNY ESF. They've been monitoring young of your muskie recruitment throughout all the coastal embayments in the region for decades. By the way, I have to give them all a big shout out for helping me with my work. You know, they're the ones that made the magic happen. So that's sort of background for that. And the work that I did, it was funded by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, thanks to relicensing of the Moses Saunders Dam, which if folks aren't familiar with that, it's a dam that stretches between Cornwall, Ontario, and Messina, New York. And part of the deal was to better understand the ecology of fish in the Lake Ontario, St. Lawrence River Basin, with some targeted research on Essex and walleye also, but to, you know, better understand how the hydroelectric operations might impact the fish upstream. So that's kind of where it all stemmed from.
So, Sarah, why focus on the juveniles? And what was the intrinsic value or the interest in the juveniles particularly?
For sure. So I'm sure, you know, lots of your listeners are aware a lot of research has gone into spawning habitat use by adult muskie and also northern pike, often followed by, you know, subsequent habitat restoration efforts. But we've also recognized the need to, you know, identify and protect habitats for the earlier life stages. We can make sure the fish, you know, have everything they need to spawn all they want, but if the resources are not available for the young to survive, then we're not going to end up with any muskie. And nobody wants a world like that. We all want muskie, right?
Mm-hmm.
So actually, a recent symposium was held on muskie management back in 2015 by the American Fisheries Society. And they found that future research, as much as, you know, can still continue on the adults, it really should start focusing on quantifying young of year survival, habitat characteristics, evaluating habitat restoration efforts, and just, you know, better understanding the life history characteristics of both the young of year and the subadult fish. At this particular symposium, my co-supervisor, Dr. John Farrell out of SUNY-ESF in Syracuse, New York, they kind of boiled things down to four different components. So prey resources, habitat, the spawning stock, and genetic resources. And so my work spawned, pun intended, from the habitat side of things. Excuse me, I'm sure many of your listeners know, you know, both species, they have self-sustaining populations in the St. Lawrence River. So this just means that, you know, they're reproducing, they're doing well without stocking efforts. But declines in muskie, you know, within the Thousand Islands region, that spurred the need to know what's going on with the populations. VHS, which, you know, is a pretty nasty disease, it did cause, many old, large females to die out previously, and that's obviously going to have some issue for recruitment. But as in a lot of cases when it comes to population declines, it's a compounded effect. You know, it's more than just one thing. So my master's, it focused on one small piece of the larger puzzle, which is exploring what habitat requirements young of year muskie and, you know, northern pike, what they need to survive the winter.
Sarah, did you have any sort of attention or any sort of correlation paid to how pike populations influence muskie populations, or did you not go down that route at all?
Didn't go down that route. As you mentioned before, you know, when it comes to research, you do have to be very specific in scope to what you're looking at. So that is certainly one of the many, you know, puzzle pieces to look at. But to be, you know, to really narrow in the scope, I was just kind of looking at exploring those habitat uses, which the results from that, you know, kind of provide some direction on how we might think that's going to influence, you know, pike and muskie together. So it's all part of the larger scheme.
Okay, Sarah, so in follow-up to that, we want to know, you know, what were your findings in that regard? I mean, I did some work when I was working with a consultant in Toronto, some habitat restoration, when we develop ponds or river edges to create fish habitat. So I'd be curious to know, what are the requirements of muskie habitat construction and how that related to kind of your research?
So I don't want to give away too much before my paper is published, if anybody's interested. But, you know, in essence, either species, it was found that how they used their nursery bay was kind of factor dependent. So how long they stayed in the bay, the size of their core range, you know, the area they actively used about 50% of the time, and the thing that influenced how long they stayed, you know, the residency, in a kind of a master variables, we look at our water level or temperature, you know, which are quite correlated. It was dependent on the bay that we were studying, which is pretty interesting. We also noted that fish that were tagged in either field season, because it happened over two different field seasons, they weren't often present within the actual kind of entrance to the bay, particularly in the second season, which to us suggests that the fish either continue to use, you know, the shallow area that is their bay, or they might in fact move out along the river. But then, you know, there's kind of that aspect of, well, they might be resident early in the season and then move out. Either region, it allows the fish to access shallow and deep areas. But if fish actually use areas outside their nursery bays, when conditions, you know, when they're not appropriate because they are quite shallow areas, and within Moses Saunders Dam, the water level can be drawn down, this can mean that their core range, the area they use, it could actually be larger than we anticipate. So there's avenues for more research there. I know we're focusing on muck here, of course, but I kind of reaffirmed something for river pike, so I wanted to share that. It seemed like a combination of cooling weather and receding water levels that it essentially prompted movement of northern pike to deeper regions. So that supports previous work that looks at elevated water levels and temperatures as being important variables for juvenile northern pike in the fall. So I thought that was pretty cool. Water level management, it could very well have a strong influence on where juveniles from either species spend their time and access resources. And so if there's a fine balance where each species are hanging out, it'd be pretty interesting to see, you know, how varying water levels, especially in such shallow environments, could actually influence the overlap between the species.
Yeah, that is interesting, and we've actually, we were running an Instagram Live here for a bit while you were talking, and some of our listeners are asking us to put up a link when you do get your paper published. If there's some sort of public access to that, Sarah, we would love to get access to that, if you don't mind, and so, so our listeners can read it and learn from it. But, I mean,
you'd also kind of mention kind of the secondary aspect of, you know, habitat use. So both species, they used areas that supported growth of submerged vegetation. Not too much of a surprise there. We know that they do in the summer, so, you know, it makes sense that they would, you know, likely continue to do that in the fall and winter, provided something, you know, is available. But we did note that there was some segregation in the habitat use. So this, you know, would suggest that the coexistence of juvenile muskie and northern pike, you know, potentially in any given embayment within the upper St. Lawrence River, and I want to focus on the system because, you know, it could very well change in other systems, so before focusing on this area, it could very well result from a combination of variables at a fairly fine scale, so, you know, right down to, you know, specific areas in the bay, rather than just how they interact with each other, which kind of comes back to your original question on how northern pike and muskie might interact.
Mm-hmm.
So this has some pretty important implications for any habitat restoration efforts, because we do obviously want to promote, you know, survival and recruitment of both species, but we don't want to increase predation of muskie by northern pike, you know, in that first year if they happen to be hanging out closely together.
Well,
so definitely, you know, once again, provide some more avenues for some more research.
But Sarah, the way you described that, it was so finite. So, like, that dynamic might be completely different in another water context, correct?
It could. It certainly could. It's definitely something that would be worth checking out.
Yeah, but I mean, George, we have a lot of listeners that fish Georgian Bay, but Georgian Bay itself, Georgian Bay itself is so, you know, expansive.
Yeah.
I mean, it's tough. I mean, have you been able... I mean, maybe this is a bad question, but have you been able to glean any sort of generalities, even with the restricted area you're talking about, the focus of the study, but have you been able to glean any sort of generalities as to where these fish go and when?
Well, see, in terms of, you know, kind of extrapolating those generalities, you know, that's what we all aim for, right?
Right.
We want to kind of have a good idea of the trends and, you know, what's going on. Can we apply that to every system?
Yeah, and muskie anglers in particularly. I mean, these are the questions that muskie anglers are, you know, that we kill ourselves trying to figure out, you know, day in and day out on the water. And so, you know, what does it mean for muskie anglers and even for researchers that are interested in this sort of thing?
Yeah, definitely. definitely. Well, like you said, those are the big questions, right? That's the information we want.
Mm-hmm.
So my work, it does provide some pretty interesting aspects on basic biology and, you know, reaffirming some things we've suspected in the past. But again, you know, it's right now it's an exploratory nature. So definitely needing to go a little bit more specific before we can, you know, and comparing different areas before we can provide those generalities.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if young musky northern pike, you know, they may in fact hang out closely to one another using different habitat features. Now, while I wasn't actually able to track both species within the same bay, we're, you know, considering these generalities by, you know, assessing similarity in use of habitat features that were in fact present in both the musky and the pike bay. You know, we know that esophids segregate during spawning, so it makes sense that they would likely do that during their juvenile years. But to what extent the segregation might occur, you know, with northern pike preferring potentially slightly deeper regions than musky, and how environmental factors can influence the segregation. That's really what's quite of interest from a management perspective, right? Especially if, you know, in terms of water level management, that's huge. So when both species are residing, you know, in a very shallow bay, often less than a meter and a half deep, again, those fine scale differences are likely quite important, especially if it's not just a depth thing, right? If it's, you know, where a particular type of habitat feature is, which for vegetation, that could be influenced by water depths themselves. So my results, you know, they could suggest that fine scale segregation between musky and pike in their first year, maybe that is what permits their coexistence in nursery bays, but compounded by water level. So really to this end, this exploration that I've done, you know, researchers wanting more details, they conduct some more, you know, targeted studies in the St. Lawrence River system to see how that, you know, interaction is playing out with respect to water levels and the specific habitat features we found. But then, you know, they can compare it and they can, you know, kind of see how the two might cozy up in another system like Georgian Bay, like the Kawartha Lake. So lots of potential questions to ask and really, you know, home in and find out what allows these two to kind of thrive their first fall and winter together. As for anglers, oh my gosh, discussing these results with everybody, it not only updates them on current musky research, but it is a great opportunity for swapping knowledge and building on what we know, you know, between the scientific community and the anglers themselves. I've chatted a lot with members of the Gananoque Muskies Canada chapter,
yeah.
And I've really enjoyed being able to provide them with stuff and then learning just a ton as well. I know that Muskies Canada, you know, they fund many musky projects and conduct them themselves in collaboration with other organizations. So really, I feel my work and not only provide some direction and to inform managers on how to conduct, you know, some juvenile musky management, but give the anglers some tips too.
Sarah, when you describe the nursery bays, can you explain it in a bit more detail? Are these like flat areas where the females go lay their eggs, males come in and fertilize, and then what happens after that? Are the fish hatched and on their own, or is there a period of time where the females are protecting the nest and you know, for extended amount of time, and then they go away, and then they're kind of just left there open for predation of other aquatic animals? Like how does that process work?
Yeah, so musky they do spawn after northern pike,
right.
which is why a lot of the predation occurs that first year, because the pike have grown faster than musky do. The pike come in to spawn kind of up in the weeded areas, you know, where the water floods pretty much after ice out. So it's quite early in the season. Neither one of them build nests. They just broadcast spawn their eggs and their sperm over the area. And as I mentioned about segregation, like I said, the northern pike, they'll go, you know, a bit shallower, and musky will go a bit deeper. So that's where that plays. But yeah, no nests. Once the adults go in, do their thing, they leave. And then it is up to the conditions within the bay to be appropriate for the fish to rear and hatch out, become fry. And then, you know, the northern pike move into kind of the more central area of the bay. And then, yeah, and then they hang out in there, rearing amongst all the vegetation. And that's where, like I said, the piece of the puzzle came with. There's been quite a few studies on what's going on in the summertime, particularly for musky. There's been an emphasis on them. But we really didn't know, you know, what's going on in the fall and winter. So that's kind of the basis for where all that came from.
Mm-hmm. So I would imagine that those areas are critical in preserving and making sure that you know, there's no damage or I guess unnecessary damage to those habitat lands, whether it's through development or
boat traffic
or whatnot. Those seem to be critical areas that you might identify to be protected.
Yeah, so I mean, that's an important goal of a lot of researchers, is to define, if possible, and quantify what the critical habitat of a fish is, so that if populations do continue to decline, or the population needs some more assistance, then there's potentially some legislative backing if it happened to go that far. Mm-hmm. But for these guys, it's just to better understand, knowing what they need. Before we can go ahead and define certain things, we just have to know what's up, right? There's a lot of knowledge gaps with respect to spatial ecology of not just muskie, but quite a few different species. It's homing in on what they need so that we can provide, a good idea of what it is they need, rather than going, hemming and hawing. It is providing that exploratory aspect first, and then it's digging a bit deeper to know what's going on. So, definitely the nursery bays are very important. But, how does that nursery bay, how does it play into their life history outside of just the summertime, right? Do they in fact just leave? Do they come back? So it's getting an idea of the importance of the nursery bay to these guys in their early life stages, not just that first summer, but as sub-adults as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, that brings up a question I was going to follow up with, was what's the relationship with that location through the duration of their lives? Like, we all know what happens with salmon coming back to the same stream that they were spawned at. So, I mean, do the muskie come back to that nursery bed throughout their lifespan, or they'll never see it again?
Well, to be honest, we didn't look too closely at that because we were only looking that first season. Okay. There's been a bunch of research wanting to understand the homing behaviors of musky northern pike. We have found, not me specifically, but other researchers have found that musky do home. They do go back to kind of the same areas. So it's really interesting. As soon as you start to find out a few pieces of the puzzle, all of a sudden just so many questions emerge that you really want to see, well, can we track them just their entire life?
Yeah.
Can we find out what they do all the time? So it's really kind of trying to pick the right moments in time to see what is going on. So whether they come back, well, that's difficult to say, off the top of my head, for the bays that I studied specifically. But we did find that we found detections, the fish that we actually captured the first season, we got some detections from them the second season within that area.
Okay.
So, there's some potential.
Right. You said, Sarah, that you didn't track any northern pike and muskie in the same bay. I'm curious to know, why? And what were your methods? Because you talked about not catching them, but I mean, how are you guys? First of all, why were you not able to track them in the same bay? And what were you doing to catch them? What was the process?
So we were seine netting. So we had a seine net out just in the bays.
Okay.
It's a protocol that the biological station has used for a lot of years. And actually, the seine netting they do, it's part of a larger fish community study monitoring program. So then we kind of tagged onto that. And if they happen, to catch the muskie and the pike, then set them aside to do our surgeries on them, and then release them where we caught them. So we tagged onto that monitoring. So like you said about not tracking them both in the same area, all of our northern pike tracking actually occurred in the same bay over both seasons. It's a well-known bay for producing both species. Biological station has caught spawning muskie in the bay. But either year that we conducted my study, we actually only caught one age zero muskie in that bay either year. So, there could be increased predation occurring. It's not known for certain. It's, I know it's kind of a bit of annoying to hear, but it is one of those puzzle pieces that we want to continue investigating. But on a really interesting note, the muskie that we tagged the first field season, I'll call it in the Pike Bay, we actually transplanted it to the bay next door, where several muskie were tagged. And we tracked that muskie in its new transplanted bay throughout the fall. It didn't leave. It kind of did the same thing as the rest. But we actually detected it back in its natal bay, you know, the pike bay, the next season. Hmm. So he or she did, in fact, move back home. And I thought that was really cool because, you know, it may have some implications for muskie management, be it knowing the area used by juvenile muskie for, as you guys have mentioned before, kind of those conservation purposes, mm-hmm. But also stocking practices, and then just having a better idea of, you know, what habitats they're using, not just in the bay, but, you know, en route if they're moving between bays. And I also kind of thought it gives some cool clues on how to set up a study to better understand actually how muskie might develop their winter range. Because we know, you know, they have the summer and winter ranges to become adults. So if we know that they return to the edge of their natal bay the second winter after being transplanted, as in the case with this one particular muskie, obviously you have to explore this with more of them, get a better sample size. But it just, that again, it provides some really nifty questions to test in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Interesting.
Well, I want to ask you about the technical side of how you track these fish. You mentioned about the acoustic transmitters, I think, at the beginning of our discussion. So with young, I mean, what size are these fish that you're inserting these transmitters in? And can you describe technically how that works and how long does that stay in the fish? And, of course, I'm sure it doesn't have a detrimental impact to the fish. So is it something that stays in for years and you study the patterns and for that time and just keep, and then it just releases and you pick it up? Or is it something, mm-hmm. I mean, how does it work?
Yeah, and how, like Chris said, Sarah, how small are these fish? How many inches are we talking?
That we were tagging, they were about 150 to 160 millimeters, so 15, 16 centimeters.
Oh,
so
okay.
I think that, I mean,
5 inches.
They're not very big.
Yeah.
They're big enough to conduct a surgery and put a tag in, but they're definitely on the smaller end of the spectrum.
Cool.
And as for, you know, the tech you use, that's a great question. You know, so like I said, we use telemetry. So that's, in essence, collecting data remotely. And for fish and some other fish wildlife studies as well, it often involves either attaching or physically, you know, implanting an internal tag in fish to answer ecological questions, which often boil down to look at where fish move and, you know, when this occurs. Lots of data can be extrapolated from this when it's combined with, you know, things like habitat features, the location of sanctuary, delineated fishing areas. So it helps answer a lot of questions about that. Now, internal tags, they're used to track fish, but the actual tags themselves, the size, everything about them is continuously evolving and being refined. So we can collect data, for instance, on the environment. We can add sensors to these tags. And importantly, this smaller tag, right, can be implanted without causing that burden.
Right.
Anybody that's attempted to capture juvenile muskie, they understand that it's a very heroic effort. there's obviously fewer to begin with. They're a top predator, and they're quite elusive. So each one we catch is considered a fairly coveted fish. So we aim to use the most up-to-date tech for data collection. So the tags we were using, they're called JSAT tags. And JSAT is an acronym, Juvenile Salmon Acoustic Telemetry System. And it was originally developed to study Chinook salmon, little ones, as they migrated towards the sea, you know, past dams in BC. And some of those guys, they are some very, very small fish, like, you know, much smaller than the muskie we were tagging. So we used this new technology to tag small size to our advantage. But not just the size, it's the shape. They're becoming more cylindrical, so smaller incisions can be made, which is, you know, important for surgery time. And then the tags are fairly streamlined in the body once they're implanted. And now the tags, they're inert. You know, there's nothing about them that, you know, is going to hurt the fish. They're very small. It's a very small percentage of the fish's body weight, which is what we aim for. And actually, part of my master's, so the one of the data trackers I did was on all of the actual telemetry information in the St. Lawrence. But the other data chapter included a hatchery experiment to determine how the surgical process and the presence of this JSAT tag, how it might influence growth, survival, behavior, right? Because those are important aspects. Yeah, fortunately, no fish died because of that, and growth was not impacted, which is great. My publication has just been submitted, so I'll leave some of the lovely suspense for when it comes out, and I'll add the link for when that happens. But I mean,
wonderful.
Technology is going to continue to advance, particularly in telemetry. It's an incredible tool for studying fish in their in their environment. And with more research focusing on understanding small fish, right? Because there's been a pretty good, we've typically focused on the bigger guys. And why the bigger guys? It's because that's the tech that we had available to us. So with increasing developments in the tech, it's only going to get better with respect to these mini acoustic tags, not just acoustic, but radio telemetry as well, to study small fish in the earlier life stages of well-known sport fish like muskie. So,
Sarah, so the when you insert that tag, you're doing it on site, like field surgery right there. You're not taking these back to a lab, right? You're doing it right in the water?
So we typically set up, like, we'll be on a boat or like a dock, you know, right near the wetland that we're working in. But yeah, it's done on site, and it only takes some very few minutes between every single fish. Because obviously we don't want to have them under anesthetic too long. So yeah, you do your first couple, and you get really good at it. And yes, I love it.
Sarah, do you,
I really enjoy this.
Do you stitch them?
It's a lot of fun.
Do you stitch them, or do they use a barb?
Pardon?
Do you stitch them? Do you stitch the incision closed, or is there just a barb on the unit that doesn't allow it to go backwards?
No, we do suture them up.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Wow. It sounds really interesting. It just sounds so interesting and so much fun.
It is, you know.
Do you need any help?
The wetlands all day. You're trudging through the muck, and well, as for one of my musky stories, I'll leave that for.
Yeah, before we get there, Sarah, I want to ask you another question. It's a bit off topic, and if you don't want to, you know, if you don't want to answer it like in detail, I can understand. But I'm just kind of curious. If you know from kind of a biological and scientific perspective, some of the kind of features and, special anatomy features of the muskie, like maybe the muscle skeletal ratio, the type of teeth structure, the speed at which this fish can attack, like just kind of the kind of what makes it the apex predator.
For sure. I mean, I obviously don't want to go into too many details because, my focus has more been understanding, you know, the ecology, so the relationships between the fish and the environment and with each other. So I've never really gotten too nitty-gritty in terms of the physiology, you know, of what's actually, you know, what makes the fish. But there's certainly some defining characteristics. I mean, the fact that it is so streamlined, and actually what's kind of cool is you can tell a lot about the ecology of a fish, and this is kind of a side story, like you said, but you can tell a lot about the ecology of a fish just based on looking at it and how it's shaped. So the fact that, you know, muskie and pike together as a sausage are very streamlined, that means that, you know, it's going to be going through the water at a decent pace, and it's meant for that. But also it's the position of the fins. So the fact that it's dorsal fin, you know, it is quite far back, and then the positioning of the other fins, that's for that, you know, quick propulsion as an ambush predator. That's what that's for. But yeah, I mean, just there's obviously way more you can go into. I'm definitely not the expert when it comes to that. But yeah, I think it's really cool whenever I'm teaching people about fish ecology, I say, you know, when you're looking at a fish, just, you know, have a good look at the fish itself. And then that tells you a ton, like its mouth position, right? If you have a fish where the mouth is pointing up, clearly it's going to be around the surface of the water most of the time eating versus, like, you know, like a sucker mouth, like on a sturgeon or a sucker, right? So it's people find that pretty interesting that you can just tell so much about a fish by, you know, and where it's even going to live just based on what it looks like. So that's definitely a point there.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's completely true. I mean, all you have to do is look at one of these fish and you can tell right away this is designed to attack, right? This is a predator fish, and as you mentioned, they're just like a physiological structure to the fish that just, you know, it just kind of what's the word?
That's what it's built for.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's not just built for predation, but built to be the ultimate predator, yeah. right? Because we can look at bass all day long, and you know, bass fishermen will stick their thumb right into a lip of yeah. bass, and you know, bass, they're mean fish and they're resilient. But then you look at a muskie, and it's like, okay, like this is a whole different beast, and it is for
yeah,
a reason.
Well, and even the you know, the ratio of like the head to the body, right? Like I don't know the exact measurements, but I mean clearly,
yeah.
you know, the adult fish that I've seen when I was out with them, I mean the size of their head is just it's a bit breathtaking. It's so big.
That's a really good word for it, and you know. Chris and I were lucky enough to be up at Sioux Lookout this year on Lac Seul fishing, and Chris got welcomed into the 50 club, and we have a picture on our Instagram of Chris bending over the boat, pulling just the head out, and it's massive. It's bigger than Chris's head. I mean, it's massive. You know,
when you have a fish that size and it also has a big girth, you just feel like you're holding something really special, and putting your hands in those fish is really intimidating. You have to have like what our guide calls the death grip. You have to put a death grip in a very safe location that's not going to damage the fish. But if you're not careful and you have kind of you know, you're not holding it properly and it does shake, you're going to lose that fish. It's going to hit the boat. It's going to go. It can damage it. You have to be very, very kind of focused and committed when you put your hand in that gill to just raise it out of the water.
Which
I've never had that experience with any other fish in Canada.
Well, so much can go wrong if you don't, like, you have to be committed is the perfect word, because if you're like, if you're willy-nilly with that grip, you know what? That is disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah, you might get your finger.
You might get your finger sliced and have it bleed for 4 days because the anticoagulants, like Chris did up at Eagle Lake 2 years ago. You know, this is what makes us muskie anglers unique, is that we have to be 100% safe with ourselves, and that translates into being 100% safe for the fish. And it's a very, very sort of unique and proud, I think, characteristic that we muskie anglers we take tremendous pride in preserving the species and the habitats. It's the top thing on our list.
As you should.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, Sarah, so before we ask you about some of your favorite muskie encounters, we want to know, how does this continue for you? Clearly, this is not like I did this work and I'm doing something. Like, this is a lifelong thing. I'm not sure if it's a muskie lifelong thing, but clearly this is your passion and you're going to be continuing in this research field for a long time. And we'd like to probably get you back. Maybe it's whenever it's a pertinent time. Maybe it's a year. Maybe it's 2 years. Maybe it's 6 months, where you have something that you can say, hey, guys, I got some new info here that I think would be really valuable to your listeners. But
that'd be great.
What's the kind of trajectory for you going forward?
So, I mean, as I mentioned, just got a position with McMaster University Research Associate, so that's fantastic. I'm really looking forward to that. Going forward, I love using telemetry. You know, the fact that this was on Musky was fantastic. But ever since I was at Fleming College, I really took an affinity to it was called our wildlife technology class. And that's where we learned about telemetry and learned how to use radio telemetry and all that. And I don't know what it was. I just loved the combination of ecology and tech together. I thought that was really cool. And all the things that you could do with it, the fact that you could, you know, just be out in these incredible environments. I mean, the fact that the St. Lawrence River was my office for a few months, you know, you can't get much better than that. So using that and, you know, being able to really get to know the fish, whether it's individuals or a population, get to handle the fish, you know, get down and dirty doing the surgeries, which is, like I said, really cool, and then releasing it, and then actually get to see where it goes, who it interacts with, you know, what it does, how are different environmental or, you know, human, you know, anthropogenic factors, how is that influencing what the fish does, and what can we do to make that fish's life better so it can go on, it can, you know, live to recruit, you know, make its offspring. And, I mean, fish are just beautiful, first of all.
I agree.
They're awesome.
We agree.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm hoping to continue conducting research as much as I can, whether it's within an academic institution, for government, something to that effect, or even NGO. I've worked for all of them in the past. All of them definitely have their benefits. And so also having all of those different experiences has really helped me to kind of, you know, even on a fine scale for myself, get to know what I enjoy doing. And the research is wonderful, kind of, you know, half my heart. But the other half is education and outreach, describing to people, you know, what I do, getting them excited to get outdoors, to get fishing, to get camping, seeing their expressions, you know, the first time they catch a fish. I actually, when I was at Carleton, my supervisor, Dr. Stephen Cook, he had asked me to instruct an enrichment course for high school students. So I did that two different times. It was a week-long course. Myself and a lab colleague organized the course. And it was so great because, you know, you have all these kids coming in. Some have the background where they've been out, you know, outdoors their whole life, and others are, you know, just getting started. So we kind of get them on the same plane. We take them out fishing for a day. You know, just some basic fishing, panfish, you know mm-hmm. nothing too much. Also, the timing of the year, we really can't fish for too much more just because nothing's really open yet.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I remember last year, the one group, you know, lots of guys and girls in the course, and the one young woman, it was so funny. You know, she just caught this little bluegill, and she goes, "Sarah, I caught a fish," and it was great. You know, she was just so excited that here she was standing in waders in this little pond, and she herself caught a fish, and, you know, I taught her how to release it, how to put it back, and, you know, that's stewardship. And that's what we all want. We want to be out there. We want to be enjoying nature, having fun with it, and making sure that other people enjoy it too. So I love all those different things, and I hope to incorporate all of those as I go in my career.
Well, one of the things that we've always noticed is that the most dedicated anglers out there are usually the best stewards of the environment.
No doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt. Definitely. Have to be. But you know, you've kind of answered a curiosity of my own, and I'm sitting here listening to all these amazing things you're doing and talking about with regard to ecology and fish and the integrity of just everything natural in this environment, and I'm thinking, like, does Sarah sit there and secretly hate us because we're anglers, right? We are stewards, don't get me wrong, but at the end of the day, we want to find those fish and we want to meet them. We're not eating the fish.
I want to meet them too.
Yeah. Okay.
Me, because no, I definitely no, I don't hate you guys. Of course not. one of the things that I have learned going through this profession, it's to have such an open mind. You know, when you're working with people, you know, when I was younger, I may have had a different perspective, but now, you know, it's like, wow, I really enjoy talking with and working with anglers and hunters because they just have such a great perspective and so much knowledge on these fish because mm-hmm. they care so much for them.
Yeah.
You know, and it's neat to see how the knowledge differs because I'm obviously collecting the knowledge in one way and looking at it from one perspective, and you guys are doing something different. So, yeah, I completely am in the same boat for I want to meet these fish too. Yeah. They're pretty awesome. I want to meet the turtles, the fish. I just want to spend time. I want to be in their company. That makes my day worthwhile. Okay. So I think we're definitely on the same page when it comes to that.
Okay, so in light of that, let's talk about your story, your fish story. Do you have anything that you can share that was just something kind of neat that you did in pursuit of a muskie or catching a muskie, or what do you got for us?
Sure. So definitely the stories aren't going to be as crazy as I'm sure as your former podcast.
Well, you didn't get a hook in the top of your head?
I don't get up fishing as much as I'd like, but I do have two stories. So one is when I, you know, was out with my crew, the Gananoque Muskie Canada guys, in a muskie fishing adventure on the St. Lawrence. And the other is actually when we were out seine netting for the little guys, for my masters. So we attempted to get a muskie. Unfortunately, I did not catch one. But to be perfectly fair, it was not the right time of year. It was end of July, yeah. You know, so it's not near that nice fall period. I do have to get back up before the end of November, and hopefully luck will change. But either way, it was a gorgeous day. You couldn't have asked for better weather, a nice breeze. The water was so still, a sneeze would have caused it to ripple. It was incredible. Now, we caught 3 northern pike that day when we were out trolling. They were all a very respectable size, so I certainly cannot complain. I reeled them all in myself. But the third one, we totally thought it was a muskie. You know, we're all sitting there nice and calm, and then suddenly that reel just starts, like it just starts spinning. So mm-hmm. I thought, oh, it's got to be a muskie.
Mm-hmm.
So it ended up being the biggest pike of the day. So I was still really happy about it, but I really look forward to getting out and hearing that reel just spin and finally getting, you know, that muskie experience. I have interacted with adult muskie when I was out helping the Thousand Islands Biological Station with some work with the spawning guys. So I have held an adult, you know, female muskie, and so I can certainly, you know, it wasn't from angling. We were, you know, with our netting procedures, but yeah, I totally agree. When you just, you feel this kind of raw sense of just intimidation.
Yeah.
When you're holding it, like, oh my gosh, but then you, like, you're kind of awestruck as well.
For sure.
So I am very happy that I've had that chance, and I hope to do it angling as well. But as for the little guys, so like I said, we were out seine netting for them. We were probably up to our thighs in just this organic muck trying to pull the net along. And then suddenly I saw this small fish, like not a minnow size, but like a juvenile muskie size, jump out of the water near the bag of the net. And that typically means that that was in fact a muskie. So we rushed to get the net closed. You know, we're trudging through. It was like running through molasses, but, you know, we're trying to get it closed before it might escape. So, you know, fortunately, you know, we got the bag up and we're sifting through the fish because we want to get the, you know, any of the esox out. And we spotted it. You know, that beautiful dorsal stripe just laying on the surface. So that was awesome. We, you know, we tracked that guy. But, yeah, I mean, as much as I love muskie, I really love and always have loved seeing the variety of species that come out of the wetland.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we captured a grass pickerel at one point.
Oh, cool.
As well as a couple of little stink pot turtles. I got a sweet spot for them, too. You know, they're tiny little guys, but damn, they're feisty. So I love running into them, too. So, like I said, not really the most exciting story, but I do plan to get out and have my own.
But curious, do you take any pictures of those fish? Like, it's really interesting to see a juvenile muskie, like a high quality photo of one up close, because that's something that you know, anglers don't really encounter a lot.
I almost caught one at Eagle.
We took lots of field photos, so we can, you know, connect and figure out. I can certainly share a couple of photos with you.
Feel free to put them up on our Ugly Pike Facebook wall if you have a second and you remember. We'd love to check them out. That's really interesting to us,
for sure.
And I'm sure to our listeners.
Well,
so
plus, you know, if because they are elusive, if you haven't seen them before, this gives you this will give people a much better idea of what to even look for.
They're really cool looking. They're really cool looking. When they're that
very
young.
Very vibrant.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah,
Sarah, this kind
of, I gotta say, I gotta say, before I forget, I really do have to acknowledge obviously Carlton and SUNY ESF for enabling me to even do this master's, which has been awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta thank the Clayton Dive Club out of Clayton, New York, because for their assistance in helping me recover receivers when the water levels went really shot way up, so they helped me with that, and Fleming College for all of their in-kind support and assistance in helping me with my hatchery experiment, and then of course just all of my funders as well.
Right on.
Just quickly before I get to the next question or just closing things out here, Fleming College, that are we referring to Sir Sanford Fleming? Did they change the name?
I don't know if it's official by any means, but yes, Sir Sanford Fleming College. A lot of people refer to it as Fleming. A lot of the alumni I talk to, so.
Okay.
But yes, Sir Sanford Fleming College out of Lindsay.
Okay, so we touched on a bit about taking some of those photos and posting them. How can people, as Frank mentioned when we were doing Instagram Live, how can people access some of your research? And if you're going to be publishing a paper in the near future, is that open to everybody? It will be online and anybody can download it, and maybe we can help you by posting that on our webs, our social media, and people can access it through there, or is it something that is proprietary, or how does that work in terms of...
The publications that go through our lab, we do eventually get them posted to our lab website. We have a great big publications list, and then they're typically downloadable as a PDF platform.
Okay.
So as soon as that becomes available, I can, you know, just share it or send the link, you know, if folks also want to check out our lab's research, because there has been, our lab has done other musky research.
Absolutely.
In the Rideau Canal and a few other spots. So absolutely, just go to FECPL.ca, so Fish Ecology Conservation Physiology Laboratory, that's the acronym, FECPL.ca, and then there's a whole publication section. So we have work on bass, you know, just a whole bunch of species. So if you're interested in that, absolutely. But yeah, we'll keep in touch, and as the work becomes publicly available, I'll get it out to you guys.
Yeah, and our Instagram is not just about taking photos of people holding fish. So if you're in the field and you're doing netting and you're kind of like tagging juvenile muskies, mm-hmm. and you snap a photo, we would love to have something like that that we can post, because it just shows a whole different Absolutely. Kind of angle of the muskie industry, and that's the kind of really interesting mm-hmm. pics that you don't see out there too often. Mm-hmm. So please feel free to share that with us.
Yeah, we're really interested in that. That's fascinating to us.
Sure, can definitely do that.
So that'd be great. Well, Chris, that was that was really amazing. I mean,
yeah, I feel like I'm back to university.
Yeah, I feel like I want to re-enroll and to change my life trajectory and study muskies and spend the time in Georgian Bay.
Well,
I mean, that's,
you know,
just...
I gotta say, you know, being in this field, it's what I've wanted for a very long time, since I was a kid, actually. It's definitely a complete side story, but I knew I wanted to be in this field after my very first time camping in Algonquin Park. And it wasn't even with fish, it was actually with wildlife that I had this experience. But what had happened was, my parents and I was 10 years old, and we went up there. It was only for one night. But in essence, the short story is, our tent got soaked. So we actually slept in the truck. And the next morning, like, our campsite was up against the Madawaska River, so it was just woods on the other side. And so we woke up, you know, early. We were just tired and sore and wanted to head home. And I will never forget this. I looked out over the river, and I kid you not, I'm not exaggerating, I saw, like, the forest swaying. I saw the trees just kind of moving back and forth. And, you know, obviously now I've got a clue, but I had no idea what was happening. I was scared. I was excited. I was, like, I just had so many emotions. I'm just standing on the bank looking down, and, you know, the bushes and everything start swaying, and it's coming closer and closer to the river. And then suddenly this black bear walks out,
oh, geez.
You know, onto the river. And it was right then and there, I was like, this is what I got to do. You know, it might not be bear, but this has got to be my office. I've got to just be out in nature, enjoying myself. So that's kind of where it all stemmed from. But, you know, anybody that wants to be in this field, you do have to be persistent. You know, opportunities, you kind of got to go where they go. I've worked in Michigan. I've worked in Nova Scotia, Northern Ontario. And don't get me wrong, I've absolutely loved the travel and getting to meet so many new people and experience so many things. But you really do have to be persistent, and you just have to keep an open mind and try new things and take the opportunities as they come.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Well said. And we really appreciate your time. And hopefully we're going to talk to you in the future again. And all I can say is thanks. Mm-hmm. Thanks for doing this with us.
Good luck with your research.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you guys having me on.
Perfect. And guys and girls, if you're listening, you know, if you like the podcast, please head over to iTunes and give us a rating and let everybody know if you like it. And that'll help us with our exposure and help us to, you know, all the knowledge we're aggregating to help other anglers and get people turned on to the podcast. We'd really appreciate that. And yeah, we've got some great things lined up in for the future, for the show.
Well, one more thing on that, Frank, is that we've had actually a lot of listeners reach out to us directly with some ideas, mm-hmm. even potential guests, and we really encourage that.
Yeah.
And we've actually lined up a few guests from listeners saying, hey, this is a guy or a girl that you need to talk to. So that's the kind of interaction that we've always hoped for with this podcast, is just reaching out back and forth and mm-hmm. sharing these stories and whatnot. So when you guys feed this information to us, then we're going to research and we're going to look into it and hopefully set up that contact. So we encourage you to keep doing that.
Yeah, please keep it coming. Yeah, that's a great point. That's really useful to us. We've gotten some of our guests through your suggestions. We have other suggestions that may be a few months old that we will circle back and consider and reach out to. So that's, yeah, it's really great to hear back from the community. So thanks, you guys.
Other than that, we'll sign off and see you next time.
Take care.